Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
This is the morning after. Sorry, we just kicked somebody out of the studio. Some transient from San Francisco. I don't know her name. But if you listen to the show later, sorry for doing that, but I didn't know why you wanted to come here in the first place. This is the morning after. We are here today to... Well, one, I wanted to follow up a little bit on the morning after awards. There was a huge... I wouldn't say... fallout, because everybody was extremely happy with the winners, and I think agreed, but I hit up a couple of places. One of the places that I hit up was Prime Eats this week and gave them their award with Jesse Kiefer, who is the producer of The Morning After. and actually, I'm going to hand Amanda Clute from Eater for Personality of the Year her award. So we'll end up on Thursday. And actually, it was funny. We did this thing, this live Twitter show that we do on Wednesday and Thursday. I'm trying to figure out a good day to do it, where we define a neighborhood, whether it be Carroll Gardens or Tribeca, and we set up a Twitter live feed about restaurants. Meaning, I was in Carroll Gardens this week on Wednesday, so if you go back and check my history on Facebook, we define what Carroll Gardens is, and we travel around and we look at restaurants between, say, the hours of 5 and 7, 1 and 3, to see if they're busy, who's opening, who's closing, take photographs, and we walk around with a specific person who may or may not be, you know, for example, if we're in Tribeca, I might walk around with Drew Neeporn for the day and ask him kind of like, what's up, and, you know, we'll see Nobu, we'll take a picture from there, and then move on. We're going to do this Thursday. We're going to do the Lower East Side, Nolita, you know, it's like, what do we, you know, is, you know, Soho, Nolita, are those neighborhoods the same, are they not? You know, how did you define these areas? And it was a lot, you know, just it was a lot of fun. One of those things that we noticed walking around Carroll Gardens was just like how many Asian fusion restaurants are just generally in New York. And we sort of added them up. It was like kind of averaged out to about 1.25 per block. And you can actually follow that. A place called Kiku had opened up. And I want to play a clip here. There was a Connecticut mayor that made this. Somebody had asked him about, where am I at here? You know, his constituents, his Latino constituents, his Hispanic constituents, and he said how he was going to relate to them. And here we go. This is Connecticut Mayor Joseph Matoro.
And that's why we can't always believe what we hear from the press. Never.
Did we get that? I'm plugged in here, Jack. No?
It was playing out of the speakers, I think.
Let me try it again.
What's his name?
Joseph Matoro. Do we get that? Let me try it again. No? It's not coming through? Yeah, whatever. What's that?
Relay it. What did he say?
Oh, I can't do it verbatim because it's about 2 minutes. I don't have that great.
Yeah, we've got it right here. Hold on.
Okay, cool. Can you pull it up?
That's why we can't always believe what we hear from the press. Never criticize without knowing the facts.
What are you doing for the Latino community today?
I might have tacos when I go home. I'm not quite sure yet. I have spent 2 years in Puerto Rico. I will probably do the same thing for the Latino community.
You realize that's not really the comment to say right now. You might have tacos tonight.
I might have spaghetti tonight. Being of Italian descent, I could go out and I've had ethnic food. And when you ask me what I was doing for Latinos tonight, I may go out and have a Latino dinner in the Latino community. There's nothing wrong with that. And you can twist it and turn it whichever way the press decides to do. Again, being someone of Italian descent, I don't know what you are, and it doesn't matter what you are. Being of Italian descent, I, in this community, have been at times thought to be of an ethnic background. And you know what? Our community is open.
I think that's enough. I think this guy's basically had enough this week. I've been playing all over the place. I thought that was hysterical. I was very offended being an Italian-American hearing that and saying that he wanted to have spaghetti. I felt really offended by that. I'm going to be a guest on a show on the Heritage Radio Network, Jack Inslee, executive producer, called We Dig Plants. Jack, next Thursday?
Oh, nice.
What
yeah.
time? When does...
It's 2 p.m.
2 p.m.?
Yeah.
What should I expect? Should I expect any hardball questions from them? It's just, I'm a little nervous about...
What do you know about plants?
Well, I know that it's really tough to, have an orchid.
Nice.
I know that's really tough.
Would you say you have a green thumb?
Yes. I think in as much as somebody from Staten Island could have a green thumb.
I don't know. Maybe I don't know what they're looking for. We'll see.
So I'm going to be on that show. Everybody, well, other than me being a guest on there, always tune into Heritage Radio Network, listen to all the shows. But I'm going to be a guest next Thursday on We Dig Plants. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with our first guest, Abe Schoner, proprietor and winemaker at the Scholium Project and Red Hook Winery. Morning after. All the leaves are brown. We're back. We're here. The morning after. Now, Abe, I apologize because I'm not hearing anything out of the left channel of my headphones, so I can't articulate myself properly, and I mispronounced something. What did I mispronounce?
You mispronounced scholium.
Scholium, and that's a derivative of a Greek word?
It is. It's from the Greek word that means leisure.
Leisure. I mean, just going by what's going on over there in Greece, isn't every word sort of always in Greek word go to leisure? Eventually
the answer
get to
is
find
no.
it. thank you for coming in, and thank you for hosting myself and Jesse Kiefer and the Terroir nationwide New York City Terroir crew at Red Hook Winery. And there was two places that we went to. One was seemed like where the fruit came in and got processed.
It's amazing. In 2008, in the summer of 2008, we had an empty warehouse space with no winemaking facilities at all. And now we have two facilities. We have what we call the old winery and the new winery. So we began at the old winery, which is where indeed the fruit comes in. And then we ended up the tour at the new winery. Pretty soon we'll have everything moved out of the old winery into the new winery. It's an extremely beautiful location, with views of the water on both sides, which I think really enhances winemaking.
The second location was breathtaking, and there were guys working while we were there. And the idea would be to have more of a, touring and stuff to get people in there to see it.
We're going to have the possibility of running a tasting room in the new facility. Even that expression, I don't like it. We were really happy having a purely industrial space before, and tasting room sounds commercial in a way that is, it's just not part of what we've done so far. But on the other hand, we really like hosting people, and we like offering our wine to people. So maybe we'll come up with a better name. But yeah, we're going to be able to receive guests every day instead of once a week.
And how did this whole project happen? How were you involved, and how did it come? I mean, it's a West Coast and East Coast.
It's about Red Hook. That's the amazing thing. The project was born by my staying in my friend's office on Van Brunt Street in Red Hook. He ran a wine distributorship out of this office on Van Brunt Street. And when I came to town to help him sell my wine, I would just stay in the back room of his office. We spent a lot of time in Red Hook because of that. And we both thought it was an absolutely amazing neighborhood. And the work that we were doing there, mainly, you know, working on our laptops and going out for dinner, we thought that that was pretty uninteresting compared to everything else that was happening. And we were determined to add something to the neighborhood and not just to be hanging out. And the funny thing is, it took a while to realize that what we could do that would really bring something to the neighborhood was make wine.
What was the stuff that you were bringing here originally when you were in New York and you said you were selling and you were spending time in Red
Hook? My Scholium Project wines, which are made in California. So I have three projects. I've got one project in California called the Scholium Project. I have a project that I'm a partner in New York called the Red Hook Winery. And then a really small project in France called Clotales.
And are these all... I saw when we were tasting, and I don't know, this is just basically because it was a time when we predominantly tasting white wines. Is that where your focus is?
It really is. It's where my focus is in California for sure, in New York for sure. And the feeling about France is we have five vineyards there in a very small town called Morie. The vineyards are all very small, each one about an acre or maybe even a little less in size. And only one of them is a white wine vineyard, but I think that the very best wine that we make there is white wine. So it's probably true that in all three places that I work, the darlings are the whites.
The biggest question during that people had asked me, we're getting a channel here. Oh, great. Somebody's standing. We're putting our hands in the right way. Now, if I put my hand up 3 feet and then I keep my left... Yeah. Okay, everybody stay. I'm kidding. I think the biggest question that everyone was asking about that weren't like really invested in wine was how can a place in Red Hook produce wine if there are no vineyards right by there? You know, in terms of that, like how does that happen for the everyday person that is just, you know, dumbfounded by Red Hook wine? What's going on? Yo, what's going on with that winery over there?
I'm going to give you a long answer to that question.
Please.
So I'm going to demand patience on the part of your audience.
This is definitely, I think, where everyone stands in terms of the New York wing.
So almost all the fruit that we work with is grown in the North Fork of Long Island, which is an absolutely amazing place for growing grapes. When I was a little kid, we used to go out there and buy pumpkins and corn in the fall, and I didn't even know that vineyards existed. I had no idea what was going to happen there. As I learned how to make wine in California and learned about all of the other places in the world that also made wine, the North Fork of Long Island had a place in what I was learning, but it did not have a prominent place. It's not a place that's really seriously respected around the world. When Mark is the guy who had the office in Red Hook, when he and I determined that we were going to make wine in Red Hook, there was no question. We were going to make wine from local grapes. We weren't going to bring in grapes like on a truck from California. So at that point, we had to start paying attention to the North Fork of Long Island. And I am so happy and so grateful that I did that. What happens out there is absolutely amazing. The possibility for growing superb wine grapes there is so strong. And it's only just being realized, not by any means only by us, but by lots of people. What distinguishes us from everybody else who's working out there is they truck their grapes 5 minutes, 15 minutes, maybe 30 minutes from the vineyard to the winery. We truck ours for 3 hours. But 3 hours is not really so significant. And it's only 3 hours because the LIE is such a mess.
We call that LIE shock.
So that's the story. I mean, the vineyards are not adjacent to the winery, even though for most of the other wineries that work with Long Island grapes, the vineyard surrounds the winery. Or maybe it's 5 minutes down the road.
Now, you were talking about the North Fork developing over time, and I brought up something called Moore's Law.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with Moore's Law?
Somewhat.
It's a technology-based law that every 2 years, price will go down because semiconductors get cheaper and information. Basically, it's an algorithm that can happen in any sort of business. But is there something that you follow in terms of pitching or creating a business plan around starting with a winery that will bring, you understand price might come down and the vineyard will work itself out over time? Is anything you go, any tables that you go off of?
So this show takes place once a week, and it's about an hour.
It is.
It would take four of your shows to get to the bottom.
But just an idea of...
No. Let me finish. To get to the bottom of how bad I am at business plans. So I really can't answer.
No, but you're definitely, you know, you have three things going on right now. So there's definitely some sort of foundation of how you...
Scarcity is the key to everything. There's no question. So with Moore's Law, semiconductors exist in almost inexhaustible quantities. If there are not enough semiconductors at any point anywhere in the world, you create one more factory, 10 more factories. One of the amazing charms of making wine is that it's not just the amount of wine is limited, but the amount of vineyard area in the world that can produce good grapes is absolutely limited. And we probably don't know all the places in the world right now that can produce great wine, but we know almost all of them, and it's so expensive to expand into more of them. So in general, what it means to do what I'm doing, to make wine in California, to make wine in New York, to make wine in France, it doesn't mean to create a new vineyard. It means to take over a vineyard and to do something with it.
And what are, what sort of, if somebody wanted to buy it, to go in a store, is there a specific area, like how does someone get to the Chardonnay that we tried the other day, you know, not necessarily the 2008 or something, but just if somebody wanted to purchase this wine?
You know, we're so much at the beginning of things that we're really not selling much wine yet, but I can tell you that in Brooklyn, our most strong supporter is the Brooklyn Wine Exchange, and they always have our wines in stock. There are two or three other really good stores.
And I want to give you another 4-hour long response. We love our East Coast and West Coast feuds, Biggie, Tupac, In-N-Out Burger, Shake Shack now, if you will. What is the big difference, other than obviously climate and stuff, that you see producing? Because you brought up a couple of points about when we were doing the tour about producing wine in California and in New York.
Climate is everything. There's nothing beyond climate. And what it really comes down to use an almost too scientific phrase, is solar radiation and cloud cover. And the difference between working in California and working with grapes from the North Fork of Long Island is all about the difference between the intensity of the solar radiation and the heat that the grapes absorb in the two places. In California, so much more heat than in New York State.
When you sit down in a restaurant and ordering wine, what are you looking for in a sommelier? Because we have a lot of sommeliers that come on here. I think now it's gotten to a point where places like Terroir, who is won wine program of the year at the Morning After Awards, congratulations to them, that defines a great somm. Because I can imagine that, you know, just like we're talking about wine, the somms in West Coast compared to, you know, the East Coast are very different. If you walk in cold to a restaurant and your name doesn't get, you know, spiked on the reservation list, and the somm comes over to you thinking you're Joe Schmo staying, you know, in Midtown, what do you look for?
You know, I think that sommelier culture in the United States now is national, and I think the somms pride themselves on that. They pride themselves on not being local in any discernible way. And my sense right now is if you drop into a place in New York or San Francisco, you're going to be offered pretty much the same kind of wines by sommeliers in both those places. The difference, as in so many things, is not the difference between one coast and another. It's the difference between the middle and the coast. So both in San Francisco and New York, you're going to be offered a certain kind of European wine with a certain profile. And in Kansas City...
You mean the flyover states?
I would never say that. I spend a lot of time in them, and I enjoy it a lot. Nonetheless, the differences are so strong because in the middle of the country, California wines have a completely different hold than they have on either coast.
And this goes back to the point we were talking about before the show. Jack, we have a clip now where Mario Batali, to talk about the nationalization of just our food culture and stuff. I took a big shot last week at Paul Dean, like everybody did. But he did something really smart, like Mario does. He defended Paula Deen in her position. Jack, are we all lined up here?
Here we go. That's, I think, we don't agree on. She said, this is her comment. She said, you can have diabetes and have a piece of cake. You can't have diabetes and have the whole cake. I mean, the fact that the whole cake is even on the table in this tells me we have to go so far off the rails on this issue.
Right.
But I don't know if you're a if you're a diabetic, you can really have even a piece of cake.
Well, once you've been diagnosed with some kind of a diabetes, you really have to take your diet into your hand. You really have to figure out type 2 diabetes can be really improved upon if you just exercise and drop a few pounds. And that's where she should be going.
Drop a few pounds?
A lot of pounds. How many pounds does it take?
Okay, well, that's a big difference between a few and a lot.
Well, exactly. Okay. I agree with you on that.
No, I mean, that's the interview is about 5 to 8 minutes long, but it thought it was good in terms of how Mary just took a position to defend our food world, how we think it's a lot bigger than it is, but it really is growing. I mean, if you think about how many networks are on TV and how many places options there are. There are only really two networks that play food, and it might seem like a lot, but they have a monopoly on it. We have the Food Network and Food Channel and stuff, and then Tony Bourdain's show on Travel Channel dabbles into that a lot. But there's only really a few places that are giving marching orders on the food world, and it should grow. And places like Heritage should have a presence somewhere. But so I like the fact that he just defended the food world to Bill Maher, who loves to take shots at anything that's not mainstream L.A. or California or Miami. We wanted to play that. That's Real Time Bill Maher. That was last Friday. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back with our next guest, Elizabeth Chubbuck from Murray's Cheese. She's the director of wholesale. We're going to talk about Murray's Cheese.
The track hits your eardrum like a slug to your chest. Like a vest for your Jimmy in the city of sex. We in that sunshine state where the bomb ass hemp be. The state where you never find a dance floor empty and pimps be. On a mission for them greens. Lean, mean, money making machines serving fiends. I've been in the game for 10 years making rap tunes. Ever since honeys was wearing Sassoon, now it's 95 and they clock me and watch me diamond shining, looking like a Rob Liberace. It's all good, from Diego to the Bay. Your city is the bomb if your city making pay. Throw up a finger if you feel the same way. Straight putting it down for California, yeah.
California.
Back here in the morning after. Wow, this is like we're filming that East Coast West Coast video here. We're going to go into our next guest, but Abe is going to introduce our next guest and then also talk about the wine we're drinking.
I'm handing over the microphone to Elizabeth Chubbuck, who is the ace cheese supplier to restaurants all around the New York metro area.
Thanks, Abe.
And it is an honor to be seated next to her.
And what are we drinking?
So the wine in front of us, sorry for leaning away from the mic, is a Strasserhof Kerner. It's a white wine from northern Italy. It's from the part of Italy that abuts...
That's Germany. Sorry.
No. But it does abut Austria, and the winemaking culture there is very Germanic. The wines have a total Austrian and German character. It's something very, very interesting to me. These wines have really influenced the way that I make wine, and sometimes it's indirectly by contrast, and sometimes by attempting to follow them.
Well, Elizabeth, actually, before we go in, now somebody, most people listen to the show on iTunes and after the fact. You've taken a sip. Now, anyone who wants to play along can go buy this bottle and they could, hear your description. We've all taken a taste. Abe?
I absolutely refuse to describe it. It's worse than talking about one's dreams. But I will say that if you go to any of the three terroir restaurants that I frequent, it'll be easy to find a wine that is close to this.
Are you looking to run for mayor in Connecticut? Are you trying to take that seat? You have a very political... Elizabeth, thank you. One.
Thanks for having me.
For coming into studio. Chin Chin, Gendani, Salud Skol, whatever part of the world we're in right now, Northern Italy, which, you know, gets confused a lot with, you know, that whole German thing. We call, you know, loyalist, if you will. but we've spoken on the phone a bunch.
We have.
And we finally met when I was a buyer, back of the house manager, steward, whatever you want to call it, for Keith McNally. I used to buy a lot of cheese from you guys. Nduja.
Nduja,
not to be confused with Nduja.
I do.
And also we used to buy the Fiore Sardo.
Yes, the flower of Sardinia.
And there's a ton of other stuff we can buy from Murray's Cheese and in the wholesale market. Just can you talk a little bit about Murray's wholesale footprint in New York City?
The footprint. Well, let's see. We work with about 400 restaurants in the city. I would say probably 300 of those are active on a weekly basis. And we have a program where we do cut and wrap by the pound. So let's see, Terroir Tribeca calls for a cheese order, and all of their cheeses are cut to order from fresh wheels that live very happily and quietly in caves.
Now, how many of those
Greenwich Village?
How many of those accounts are on COD? I'm kidding.
proprietary information.
I told you. You thought this is the Sunday show. That's the hidden gem. A lot of people don't realize that you guys are, you know, very close. You have a great inventory, and I think a lot of new chefs and chefs that come into the city don't take advantage of the Murray's Cheese of the world because they feel like it's not. I need to buy directly from this company because I'm like, you know, by basis farm to chef because they seem like they're in touch with the farmers, but you guys are seriously in touch with the farmers. You're moving so much product.
Yeah, we move a decent amount of product, but we also have prime storage conditions for the cheeses. Yeah. So not only are we working with different farmers and producers to select the best of their products in order to curate a collection that sort of hits all the different points, milk type, flavor profile, geographic location, scope of production, but then we're able to bring those cheeses in and store them on wooden shelves and temperature and humidity controlled spaces.
Yeah,
we
gotta watch out for those that bacteria that's floating around. But exactly. Anyone that's ever been to the Ghost Bar at the Palms on the on the roof, there's a weird part if you're drinking too much Red Bull or something like Demi Moore, and you're actually looking down the it's a transparent floor, and you can actually see down whatever 50 flights to
it's a window into our subterranean world of cheeses.
And yeah, and exactly, and Murray's, you can walk down, you can actually see the cave, if you will.
Indeed. Okay. Usually you're looking at a wheel of Parmesan or a couple wheels of a cave aged Gouda.
The Parmigiano Reggiano and the Grana Padano. Those two arguments. What is that all about?
Oh, that
can't the Grana people get along with the Parmigiano Reggiano?
There's room for all of them in the world.
Is that just basically classification thing?
Yeah, different regions, different protection. So.
And Wisconsin kind of dabbles into that a little bit too. They try to brand themselves as, you know, the Grana, Parmigiano Reggiano, into a point where you actually look at the label somewhere and you see, oh no, this is actually produced in the USA.
There's a producer in Wisconsin called Sartori, which has been in operation for about 100 years, and they make a Grana-style cheese, which if you buy it in Wisconsin, it will be listed as Parmigiano. In New York, we sell it as Sartori Cervecchio. We're not really in the business of calling cheeses by names other than what they really are. So we don't want to misrepresent a Wisconsin cheese and have our consumers be confused and think it's Parmesan.
No, especially after the Packers lost. I don't think they could take those two things in 1 week.
The interesting thing about Sartori is that these Grana style cheeses live in a brine for the first week or a few days of their life, and the brine that they have at Sartori is the original brine. It's 100 years old, and up until maybe 30 or 40 years ago, they just let it sit. Now they have to run it through a pasteurizer every day, but it is still the initial brine, which is just full.
It's the mother
of micro. Yeah, the mother, full of microorganisms and salty deliciousness.
One of the things we get from a lot of listeners, they love to hear about the schedules of people and not the intricacies of stuff. Now, somebody that deals with, you know, bipolar chefs and GMs and on the phone all day, on the wholesale side, what is your schedule?
It depends on the season, but typically 9 to 6:30 8 to 5:30 or 7. And everybody, depends on the day.
Everyone calls at 6:15 to put their orders in.
We get calls from. I mean, we have someone in the office at 7:30 in the morning to get those early risers or the late nighters, and we have people there until again 7 o'clock at night. So we've got coverage all the time. But you know, I get emails from my chefs at 12 o'clock and 12 o'clock at night after midnight.
They get mad.
Yeah, shoot them an email about menu changes.
They're like, I'm in at a tavern right now. Do you want to get a drink? No, actually, I need to put an order.
Exactly.
that kind of relationship where they text
exactly.
you.
They're asking me about raw versus pasteurized milk at 2 a.m.
You're not like a restaurant person. You came from advertising, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how long have you been working at Murray, and how did that whole thing happen? Because I think a lot of people, whether you want to call it the economy or just love or passion and following their dreams, kind of are, can have, like the same where you're at.
Sure. I came to Murray's in June of 2009, so almost 3 years ago. And I had been selling advertising for a big magazine, and I used my expense account to bring clients to Murray's Cheese for classes.
Oh, great. So you're the one that's responsible for the...
Okay. As a way to entertain them, because I didn't like to get my nails painted, and I didn't really want to have to make... Well, I didn't... I'll just stop there. Suffice to say, I was interested in cheese, and it was a unique thing to do with my clients.
And there's that awesome tasting room there, right?
They have an amazing, very robust education program at Murray's where you can really... You can just go for a lovely evening of having your palate expanded and your mind blown with really enticing adjectives. Or you can go for a 3-day boot camp in which
you said it, not me.
I did. Enticing adjectives. You can go for a weekend-long boot camp where you're learning more about the science, the chemistry of milk, the science of cheese making, you know, differentiating between the different styles. And
but then you called them, or they followed up with you. How do you end up in there?
I spent 2.5 years volunteering in the classroom at Murray's, only because I couldn't get.
So you got street cred.
Well, yeah, I sat down in front of a cheese plate one time, and there was a piece of Latour, which is a Robiola style triple milk cow, sheep, and goat from Piedmont, and it smells like wet hay and raw buckwheat honey and funky dried flowers and animals. And I was sitting there waiting for the class to start, and I wasn't even aware of the fact. I wasn't intentionally trying to smell it, but the smell from this cheese, the perfume, just sort of wafted up into my nose, and my heart melted. It was as if somebody had put a puppy dog in my lap. And I thought, oh man, I got it bad. I got to explore this a little bit.
And that's how, and here we are.
That was, yeah.
If somebody, new restaurant that's listening, wanted to, they're passing notes here back and forth. Can we read those? If somebody wanted to open an account with Murray's, is there a process that we have to do? Go online, fill out a credit app, of course.
Give us a call. Tell us you love cheese.
Okay, what is it, an email or something?
Yeah, and people find us online. They pick up the phone. They send us. There's certainly a form on the website where you can go put in all of your information. The more information that they give us in terms of the scope of their restaurant, the type of cheeses they're looking for, will help us know kind of how to react quickly.
And your favorite cheeses, anything that pops out, one or two?
Favorite cheeses.
Is this like Abe? Don't be Abe the politician right
there's,
now, please.
There's a cheese called Etivas, which comes from...
And you
have
to play the safe esoteric one. it's his mom. I know. Okay.
How many cheeses can I talk
about?
No,
but like one, you know, I think a lot of people follow up, and if they follow the Jason Clucci on Twitter,
yeah.
We go and Murray's Cheese, they can go there and they'll buy one or two things that they normally wouldn't have.
So the Etivas is a cheese that is quite pricey and well worth the dollars spent. Etivas is what I like to call the OG. It's the original Gruyere. So in the 1920s, there were a bunch of Gruyere producers who were starting to feel a little bit strangled by the restrictions of the AOC. And they thought that
And the AOC briefly is?
Appellation d'origine contrôlée. So the governing body that defines how the cheese has to be made, where it has to be made, the terms of production, the time of year in which it can be made.
Mom, that was not a curse word in French.
I swear. And so these producers broke out of the Gruyere AOC and they created a cheese called Etivas, which is a more authentic version of Gruyere. So there are currently only 37 producers of Etivas, and each one of these people are making cheese in a little chalet up in the mountains. So when I say a little cheese chalet, I think I think in the United States we have this romantic idea about chalets being sumptuous and spacious, but they're probably two rooms built into the side of the mountain with a cheese room on the ground floor and living quarters above, with an aging room, you know, sort of dug into the mountain behind the chalet. And they only make the cheese from May to September, when there's enough grass in the mountains that the cows can be out eating these lush mountain pastures. And the milk is collected. It's cooked in copper vats on open wood fires. The rooms are soot blackened. And the cheese tastes like...
Sounds like my apartment when I was bartending.
Exactly. Cheese. It tastes like pineapple and garlic and onions and rich, savory bone broth.
Do you speak French or are you just trying to impress everybody?
A little bit? A little bit.
Okay, fair enough. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back with Abe and Elizabeth. We're going to have a little bit of cheese and wine panel here. This is The Morning After. We're back here at The Morning After. We have our wine and cheese. This is a prelude to our wine panel that we're having in 2 weeks, so we can kind of get basically all the you know, work out all the kinks. So I'm sitting down. You're my server, Elizabeth, and you offer. I want to order an OG. I'm going to order some Gruyere. I'm going to order some Comté, one of my favorite mountain cheeses, and I'm trying to think of some other. I'd say
got to get a goat in there for you.
Fiori Sardo,
sheep's milk.
Okay, sheep. There we are. And then I'm going to get what you pick. You're my server, please.
Sesoche.
Please, can you send my Sam over when you have a chance?
Indeed.
Oh,
indeed.
Please. Oh, he's so well dressed. Here we are. He's coming over right now. Hi, sir. How are you? I don't know if you spoke to our server, but we ordered an array of cheeses. Can you recommend something in the $75 to $125 range?
You will drink a Old World with this cheese selection, and nothing will go better than that.
I'm sorry. So, Sarah, what is that?
It's Sancerre. Pardon me.
Is that
me
like
for...
the French cheese, Saucisson? Does that have anything to do with that?
So, we eat so much cheese at my table. I would say the culmination of every meal is cheese. And we drink so much champagne at my table, but the one thing that we, in general, do not drink champagne with is cheese.
Really?
Yeah. Do you favor the two?
Ooh, I like champagne for like the soft, mouth-coating, velvety cheeses, or the triple cremes. Anything that has that like mouth-coating texture.
I agree with that. And there's something about the luxuriousness of each one that even, like, I'll be honest, like even if in the mouth it's not perfect, in concept it's perfect.
In concept, and any of the sparklers that have any of those like brioche bready notes to them are going to pair really well. And things that are a little heavier bodied.
Jack, could we for the quote of the show, the culmination of every meal is cheese for Abe. I think that's a great. No, all kidding aside, we kid here at The Morning After. I think that would be a great quote. But you guys work in two different worlds that come together a lot. There's a lot of information out there. There's a lot of the high priests of cheese and wine. But, you know, you're here and you're having fun with it. Demystify some of the stuff that we see, guys, in terms of...
My inclination is to say, fuck no.
No, the information's out there, but it's we're sitting here, we're talking, we're having like a fun conversation. But I feel a lot of people that go out, they just get intimidated by a lot of stuff. And one of the people who is a key in the culmination of the wine program of the year, The Morning After, and just an amazing place is the terroir world. Hello. Is Stephen Solomon.
Am I on?
And Stephen. And Stephen.
Can I have a sock for this? I want to rock the mic.
Stephen, you are responsible for all of the great.
And I say, what? Yes.
All the the great marketing that comes out of terroir. And I think one of the great parts about that Marco and Paul Greco are doing over there are
right.
they made it fun. They've taken a lot of stuff. They've brought a lot of producers to, you know, in really hard areas. You know, Tribeca, Murray Hill.
It was rough.
Park Slope. Yeah. Try getting some stockbroker not to order a big cab, you know, having coming in there.
Yo, when we talk, Merrill Lynch listens.
You know what I mean? And you have Citigroup there. So what is your affiliation
they
with
Tawar? They drink what we want them to drink.
He's not only a painter, he's also a comedian, please, a comedy
right,
stylist.
I gotta say, that was an hour's worth of questions. I guess that I would go back to your saying that we make it fun, and I think that the thing about terroir is it's fun already. And one of the most important things is to dust off all of the things which have accumulated around a very primary, beautiful experience, eating with your friends, drinking wine with your friends, connecting with people around you. And we love history. We love the culture of wine. We love all of the things that are the root of it. But we'd like to reformulate. We'd like to go back to the roots and scrape away a lot of other stuff. So in a way, making it fun, we're just connecting with the way that we always talked about food and wine amongst one another. And when Abe's talking about a kind of a national culture of food geeks and wine geeks, I mean, it's the way those are the references that we have. We didn't think of, gee, how can we market this? It's that actually what we're doing is more authentic than that and less contrived and more organic, because we're just doing it the way we all talk about it. And it turns out that when you trust people, when you trust the guest and talk about it exactly the way you talk about it with one another, the guests click into that because they're also part of that culture. So I would say the question of whether it's Murray Hill or whether it's, you know, any neighborhood, any place, trusting people and being authentic and being direct and being jokesters and pranksters and playing games. Sure, there's room for that. When you say OG, talking about original Gruyere, Elizabeth, I think that that's absolutely that in a kernel is you communicated it all in a pithy way. Boom, that's it. And I think that's kind of what we're doing.
Yeah. What is one of the favorite shirts or sayings or slangs or things that you created or you guys worked as a team that we've seen?
I guess the elevator, the thing to do is to go back and say, what do I do?
Exactly.
What do I do or how does this work?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so I'm Stephen
Solomon.
Hence
the first question.
Right. What do we have? A minute left, right?
No, we have plenty.
We have a minute.
We have plenty. Everyone here is, we need a 10-hour Lincoln Douglas format for next week.
My model is Fidel Castro. I like to have a room to explore my ideas.
Well, that makes sense because you put a lot of beer, people with beers on those t-shirts. So
right,
that makes sense.
Right, beers. Okay, so my job is, I'm Stephen Solomon. I'm a painter. I am a collaborator and partner in Terroir Wine Bar and a co-creator of it. Paul, Marco, and I—this whole thing is a band, you know—and different people play different roles at different times. But one of the things that was important was when we were originally talking about the idea of opening up a wine bar that would be like our punk club to scrape away at what we considered maybe the prog rock of wine lists that we're not into.
There we go. Now we're getting
and get
into
back
it.
To what was, you know, what it is that we love and what it is that we want to do and how. And if you look at the text of Paul's wine lists to begin with, they were already the free associative Hunter S. Thompson style, gonzo style of wine writing.
Yeah.
And so the most natural thing when we opened the first terroir was, since the wine program,
the one in the East Village,
yes, on East 12th Street, since it no longer had to serve the food in a traditional hierarchy where the chef is the rock star, and you know, can you imagine having Paul Greco as your sideman? I mean, how awesome was that for Marco? One of the most awesome things I think for Terroir was by putting the spotlight on Paul, on the way he thinks about things and the way he talks about things, is people then got to discover Marco through the side door. They actually get to, I think more people learn about Marco's food and love Marco now.
Oh, I thought it was because of the Iron Chef, but that was just me.
The Iron Chef thing? Yes. What's that? What was that Iron Chef? What is this Iron Chef you speak of? But anyway, the thing is that
the look and feel of the wine list. When you ask, you know, why is the wine list covered with, you know, graffiti style or very aggressive or whatever. Yeah. The original idea for the East Village
Dadaist
was...
Dadaist or Fluxist, whatever.
Right. Yeah. The original idea of the wine list was to take that text, which was already beginning, already germinating at hearth, and give it free rein. And in a way, it was the metaphor for that one. Each wine list has its own metaphor, and all the visuals kind of grow from that. But the idea was that this is the... Imagine Paul Greco as a junior high or high school student. This is his notebook, and all these mad ravings are like, you know, it's his Perfect. Little cerebral cortex. So the T-shirts, the posters, the stickers, the all that culture, Trickle. That's the way that we communicate. That's the stuff we always loved. Our favorite bands, you know, our favorite stuff always had those things. And so we basically just created, when you got to the first terroir in 2008, it was as if the culture had already existed. We created a backstory where you came in and there were stickers that said, you know, Tumo for too much oak. And, you know, it had pictures of, you know, Greco-Roman, you know, catastrophe.
It was fun. I remember I was working at Tribeca Grill at the time, and I remember it was like one of the exciting places that wine, you know, somms went to and met after their shifts. They went to Terroir in the East Village, and they hung out there, and then the one at Tribeca opened, and here we are now. You guys are opening another location in Park Slope.
Yeah, there's 35 actually currently in the New York area. So the thing is that we're opening up, actually. There's a
Don't
border.
Don't confuse people. They take everything literal.
There's a mountain. When people talk about the slope, see, we're not really talking about Park Slope. There's a mountainous range that runs between North Korea and China, and it's the highest place in altitude between the two countries, and we're actually opening up there in the spring.
Talk about terroir.
Oh, it's pure. It's schist and slate. We're very excited. We're very excited about the whole thing. It's the Badu Mountains. I don't know.
No, it's good. Well, if you open in North Korea, it's great for the wine world because you guys can control any information that comes out of there.
Let's just say that we love a man in a uniform. Anyway, so to answer which is the favorite T-shirt, I mean, that's my long-winded way of saying the T-shirt is part of the game. I do think that the original Bartolo shirt as the take on Che Guevara, and when I'm researching it, there were pictures of Bartolo already wearing a beret. It turns out he was a socialist and a partisan during World War II. I was looking up the World War II history of, and I was a little bit nervous. And then I got to the pay dirt. He was like hanging out, drinking his, you know, wines, drinking Barolo with Primo Levi, you know, in the 70s and 80s. He was an amazing guy. So to me, the fact that all we had to do is add the star to the beret and we had the whole thing, and that Bartolo himself was the real deal, and that his graffiti, when he was no longer making wine, he did wine labels, and he's the one who wrote No Barrique, No Berlusconi. We didn't invent that. That was something that Bartolo Mascarello actually did himself. So I have to say, if I have to pick one shirt, picking the first shirt isn't a bad place to start.
Okay. Elizabeth, what are we eating here?
Oh, so we have three cheeses. The first one is from Twig.
I'm going to filibuster that.
Yeah, Twig Farm in West Cornwall, Vermont. It's called Goat Tome. So it's a mixture of raw cow and goat's milk. That is aged about 80 days. That's this one here. So smooth, pasted, a little bit of a goaty flavor to it.
How much is this a pound wholesale around? Yeah, I mean, ballpark.
It's not something we keep in our regular inventory.
Go on a website and look.
Yeah, I think probably, I'm going to guess 28 a pound retail. But that, I mean, those are retail prices.
Yeah.
And then in the center there is a cheese called Winnemere from Jasper Hill. And this is the first batch we've gotten this year. So Winnemere is a raw cow's milk, washed rind cheese that is bound in spruce bark and then aged for 60 days. And so basically what happens, they put the spruce bark on the outside of it because as this...
By the way, Abe has a knife on him and he's cutting into the thing.
It's a gnarly looking knife too. As they age this cheese, the paste becomes loose and supple and silky like pudding. And the spruce on the outside not only imparts some nice like deep forest and like wet leaf flavors and aromas to the cheese, but it also just contains it. It keeps that cheese from bursting right out of its rind, which is what it wants to do.
Okay.
And then the last cheese is what I like to call, it's sort of the jazz of cheese. It is a blue cheese that defies all standards of blues. It's called Dunbarton Blue, and it comes from Roelli, which is a cheesemaker in Schulzburg, Wisconsin. And it's essentially, without getting too much into the mechanics and chemistry of blues, it's sort of an aged cheddar that they inoculate with blue mold spores, and then they pierce the wheels to let the oxygen in so that the blue mold will start to grow. But right after piercing, they press it, which collapses the veins. It inhibits the growth of blue mold. And what you get is a cheese that's sort of like a pairing in and of itself.
Well, thank you for all my guests for coming here today with all of your great responses. Speaking of jazz, we can contact Ken Burns, and hopefully he'll make a documentary about everyone's response to all my questions. This is The Morning After. Please tune in next week. We're doing we're going to check in with all five boroughs, with different sports bars, from Mile End to the Meatball Shop Boys to Lee's Tavern Pizza in Staten Island. I'm Jason Colucci. Follow me at The Jason Colucci on Twitter, Facebook page, The Jason Colucci. Thanks, guys. Thanks to all my guests. Talk to you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.